Yes, so thanks for inviting me to give a talk. I'm going to be talking about turbulent gravity in asymptotically ADS spacetimes. And this is work that I've it's covered in these four papers here, and those were written with Lewis Lehner, Steve Liebling, Alex Bouchel, and a couple students, Federico Carrasco and Antoine Maillard. So usually one works in for astrophysics in asymptotically flat spacetimes. And in asymptotically flat spacetimes, or spacetimes with black holes, you have quite a lot of dissipation. And this is because, well, in this Penrose diagram, you can see radiation that exists in the part of the universe that we live in can propagate out away to infinity, and it'll never come back, or it can fall into the black hole and be absorbed. So these are the two sources of dissipation in gravity. And for this reason, gravitational perturbations tend to decay very rapidly. And once you have, say, a perturbed black hole, it will just decay via quasi-normal modes, and you don't usually have to worry about nonlinear interactions. So this was seen, of course, by LIGO recently when they saw this ring down of the lowest quasi-normal mode after the merger. However, what one can do is work, instead of in asymptotically flat spacetimes, asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetimes. And in these spacetimes, instead of having a null infinity where radiation can pass out through, you often will impose a reflecting boundary at your time-like infinity. And then if you have a perturbation, it can propagate out to infinity, but then it will come right back and it can interact further with your system. As a result, you don't have as much dissipation, and you can tune the parameters of your system such that the quasi-normal modes become very long-lived. And in fact, so if you take a very large black hole in anti-de Sitter, as you increase the size of that black hole, the lifetime of these quasi-normal modes goes to infinity. And that gives you more of a chance to have nonlinear interactions between them. You can go even further and just take the black hole away, in which case you just have global anti-de Sitter spacetime, and you have no source of dissipation. So your quasi-normal modes then are replaced by normal modes of this system. And it's best just to think of this as some sort of mirrored box which has a set of normal modes. So in both of these cases, this reduced dissipation means that nonlinear gravitational interactions, including turbulence, can be studied in those backgrounds. So I'm going to talk about these two cases, the large anti-de Sitter black brains in four dimensions, and pure ADS spacetime. So the talk will be divided into two, and I'm going to talk about these two things. So for the large ADS black holes in four dimensions, a lot of this work is motivated by this gravity fluid correspondence, which tells you there's some sort of connection between black hole perturbations and fluid dynamics. And I'm going to go over that. And then I'm going to study a fluid instability, the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, but in the context of gravity. And then that will lead to turbulent perturbations around these black holes and energy cascades and a new conservation law, which I'll discuss. And then in part two of the talk, I'll get rid of the black hole and study small perturbations of just pure anti-de Sitter spacetime and how they interact. And in fact, there's an instability to formation of a black hole in this spacetime. And I'll introduce a two timescale analysis for studying this and discuss the dynamics. So first, the large anti-de Sitter black brains. So there have been many hints for a while of some sort of connection or analogy between fluid dynamics and gravity. So of course, there's black hole thermodynamics that tells you your black holes have the properties such as temperature and entropy, like fluids would. There's this membrane paradigm for black holes. More recently, there's been this comparison of this instability of a stream of water to fragment it into drops. That has an analogy with five-dimensional black strings, which Lewis Lehner and Franz Pretorius have studied numerically. So here we just take a black string, which is a black hole across an extra dimension, and it's unstable to formation of these five-dimensional black holes. So just comparing these pictures, there's just some hints of a connection between fluids and gravity. So we just see this self-similar behavior here where these black holes continue to form on this string. But this connection can be made more rigorous using this gravity fluid correspondence. So we have the ADS-CFT correspondence, which tells you that quantum gravity in a d plus one dimensional space-time, which is asymptotically anti-de Sitter, is somehow equivalent to a d-dimensional conformal field theory living on the boundary. But there's a purely classical limit. I'm not going to talk at all about any sort of quantum field theory. And in this limit, the d plus one dimensional quantum gravity theory becomes just a theory of classical gravity describing perturbations of d plus one dimensional black brain spacetimes, which are asymptotically anti-de Sitter. And then the boundary theory becomes fluid dynamics. So we have this connection between black holes in ADS and fluid dynamics on the boundary. And this is called this gravity fluid correspondence. And it's for what we want to study, it's easier to study this boundary fluid. So we're going to study this boundary fluid and obtain approximate solutions to the Einstein equation by using this gravity fluid correspondence. So the picture that we have in mind is pretty simple. We have, here's a black brain, an asymptotically ADS black brain spacetime. So here's my boundary on the right, and this is my event horizon. And you can imagine perturbing your black brain spacetime by putting some initial data on some slice. I've drawn a null slice, but you don't have to use a null slice here. And solving Einstein's equation in the bulk for this perturbation, and fixing at the boundary that the metric has to, the asymptotic induced metric is just flat. So this is like if you solve the wave equation in this setup, you can impose a Dirichlet condition as a boundary condition, and then you're not free to impose the Neumann condition or the time or the radial derivative of this. So that radial derivative in this case is the boundary stress energy tensor. It has to do with the extrinsic curvature at infinity. So it's a perfectly well-defined initial boundary value problem to set up initial data and impose that the boundary metric is just reflecting, it behaves like a mirror, and then solve the Einstein equation. And the output being this boundary stress energy tensor. Now, what the gravity fluid correspondence tells you is that at late times, this boundary stress energy tensor takes the form of a relativistic viscous conformal fluid. And this is derived in a derivative expansion that's valid for long wavelengths. So then once we have that property, we can then go back and reconstruct the bulk metric and learn something about what's going on in this space-time at late times. So I'm not going to go through the derivation, but the result is that this boundary stress energy tensor, it's expanded in derivatives, but to zero orders in derivatives, we have a perfect fluid stress energy. And that perfect fluid is then described by a density rho and a three velocity, in this case, u along the boundary. These are all functions of boundary coordinates. And it's living in flat space. And the pressure is chosen such that this stress energy is traceless or conformal. At first order, in derivatives, you get your viscous parts. So we get a shear tensor, a shear term here, that's our leading viscous part with shear viscosity, where eta is this viscosity. And it's related to the density of the density rho. And then to second order, we get additional terms, and we're going to study these as well. But I think they're less important in the whole picture, at least for what our purposes are. Yeah, thanks. Okay, will this one work for the? Oh, it does work. Okay. Okay, so. Like I was saying, so we have our boundary stress energy tensor, and then we have a dual bulk metric, which is expressed in terms of the same quantities, the four velocity or the three velocity on the boundary, and rho. So we have this duality between metrics in the bulk and stress energy tensors on the boundary. Yeah.
Do you know why there isn't any bulk viscosity?
Because that wouldn't be conformally invariant. Yeah, so that's why we just have a shear viscosity. Okay, now let's go back to the black brain picture. Yeah?
When does the bulk metric depend on the pi mu?
The pi mu? It does. Oh, yeah. So I've only written this to zeroth order and derivatives. And there would be additional terms. Yeah, I didn't have space. So then Well, let me just say one more thing about this. This is exactly a black brain metric. If the U and the rho were constant, this is a black brain metric. But we're going to allow them to depend on X, and then that's no longer a solution to the Einstein equation, but it is when you add in higher terms in the derivative expansion. So, yeah. Okay, now going back to the black brain picture, the perturbation modes at the linear level of the black brain are quasi-normal modes. And, well, Aaron's going to talk a lot more, I assume, about quasi-normal modes in his next talk, but I'll just give you a brief summary. So we can divide the perturbations into two channels, which we call shear and sound. And for each, let's look at the shear channel. We can, you know, fix our dependence on dimensions tangent to the brain, the spatial dimensions tangent to the brain. And then once we do that, we have a whole set of modes which have different radial dependence. So we have our fundamental mode. These are the frequencies in the complex plane. We have our fundamental mode, and we have these higher modes up here with more nodes along the radial direction. And so we have these three modes. There's the lowest shear mode and the lowest sound modes. And these are the ones that are captured by the dual fluid, at least at the leading order. The higher order modes up here, these decay faster, so at late times, they're less relevant. The ones that persist are the longest living modes, the lowest ones. So this is the imaginary part of omega along this axis, so a negative imaginary omega leads to a decaying mode. And the shear mode, the shear hydro mode in particular, that has a purely imaginary frequency. And as you take the temperature of the black brain, or the size of the black brain, to infinity, its decay time goes to zero. So it approaches this real axis, and it becomes arbitrarily long-lived. And like I said already, I mean, the higher modes, they're not captured necessarily by the dual fluid at leading order, but they decay more rapidly, and they're not relevant at long wavelengths. Now let's look at that from the fluid side. On the fluid side, that shear hydrodynamic quasi-normal mode of the brain becomes a shear flow of your fluid. So what I mean by that, that's a flow where you have, say, a non-zero x component of your velocity that depends on the y coordinate. So you have this flow that's moving like that. So we can set that up. You imagine having a background which is just a constant uniform fluid flow just sitting there. And you linearly perturb it with your shear flow, your x component of your velocity, a function of y. And you can find the dispersion relation of your modes. And you find omega is proportional to minus ik squared over t, the temperature. And that's exactly the dispersion relation you saw in the quasi-normal mode. So the linear perturbations of the fluid are the same as the linear perturbations of the black hole, as you would expect. But the fluid equations are nonlinear. And what we're going to do is use the fluid gravity correspondence to study the 3 plus 1 dimensional black hole perturbations at the nonlinear level via numerical simulations of the 2 plus 1D fluid. And we'll choose initial data corresponding to the shear mode and study its evolution under the full nonlinear fluid equations. And then we're going to also have tiny perturbations to assess the stability. So if I just put in a shear flow at a low Reynolds number, I get what I expect. So I'm plotting here the vorticity of my fluid. This is, remember, we're doing this in 2 plus 1 dimensions. The vorticity as a function of time, and it just decays exponentially. This is the L2 norm of the vorticity. That decays exponentially because it's just a decaying mode, and it's exactly what we expect. And this is really a laminar flow in the fluid. And similarly, we can plot the L2 norms of the x component of velocity and the y component. So the y component is non-zero because we added just a tiny bit of noise here. And all of them decay exponentially. But now I can turn up the temperature of that black brain and look at a shear flow at a high Reynolds number. So here I'm plotting the vorticity field. I'm using periodic boundary conditions. And if I allow this to play, it just decays for a little bit. But then eventually it becomes unstable. And this is the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. And it forms into these turbulent eddies. And if you look closely, you can see they're getting bigger. And this is known as the inverse energy cascade for 2 plus 1 dimensional fluids. And you transfer energy to longer distance scales. And now we have just a few vortices remaining, rotating in two different directions. We have the red and the blue ones. And if like vortices will merge together. And if they're rotating opposite ways, they will repel. And eventually, this is going to settle down to two vortices, one going each direction. I won't show the whole thing. So let's go through that piece by piece. Well, we have that initial instability you saw, where that initial flow gets disrupted. And if we look at the y component of the velocity, which was initially zero, we can use that to monitor the growing mode. So here I'm just plotting the UY field during that initial growth period. And we see that it's also a shear mode, but it has a longer wavelength than the initial flow. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 wavelengths fitting in there, and before that we had something like 10. So we see this, it's unstable to growth of another shear flow. And we can see that in these plots. Well, if I look again, this is a similar plot to what I had before. If I look at the x and y components of the velocity, the x component continues to decay exponentially as before, but now the y component is blowing up exponentially. And so this is losing its energy to this y component of velocity, and it's also losing energy to dissipation. But the point is that this is able to reach the amplitude of the initial perturbation, and at that point, everything goes crazy and you get this turbulence happening. The vorticity mostly decays exponentially during that time as well. Okay, now, after that happens, you get this fully developed turbulence and this clear inverse cascade happening here. So, so this inverse cascade transfers energy to the larger scales. Now, why does this happen? Well, it's because of this conserved entropy. So in 2 plus 1 dimensional, I'll look at Navier-Stokes incompressible fluids for simplicity here. We can write the Navier-Stokes equation, and just to emphasize, I and J run over X and Y, just the 2D components. You take the curl of that equation, and then you get an equation for the single component of vorticity, because we're only in two dimensions, there's only a single component of vorticity. And it tells you that up to these dissipative terms here, this is just going to be, you know, conserved or advected around like this. The omega will be, sorry. And this means also that any power of omega is also conserved. So in particular, omega squared integrated over the space is a conserved quantity up to dissipation, which of course, remember, we're taking to be very small. So because you have this conserved quantity in addition to the energy, it means that your entropy cascades to shorter distance scales, but your energy cascades to longer distance scales. And this is a special property of two-dimensional turbulence. Okay, during this time, the vorticity, instead of displaying an exponential decay, now obeys a 1 over T power law. And finally, at the end, you get everything settling down to two vortices, and at that point, they decay exponentially. But like I said, I mean, we're not just going to study the fluid theory. We're interested in gravity. So we can, in fact, use that mapping that I had earlier to write down, I mean, to write down a metric in the bulk that corresponds to that boundary fluid. So that's what I'm doing here. I'm plotting this quantity, I'll tell you what it is, along these along like a tube connecting infinity through the horizon here. And this is just one of the Weil invariants. So this is the dual of the Weil tensor times the Weil tensor. And as you can see, I mean, it looks like these funnels kind of running along these null curves. It looks exactly the same as the vorticity field. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So what are the restrictions on these transverse type modes that
you're right. So if you had the higher modes, I think you would see more fluctuations radially, because this is like you're right. This is like the fundamental mode moving along here. Of course, at late times though, I think this is what's going to be relevant, because the higher modes are going to decay very rapidly. So this is kind of the late time behavior one would expect. Yeah, you have decay in both sectors, but in the limit where you go to high temperatures, this is the one that's going to be persisting longer.
So this time scale is.
You can make it a longer time scale. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when things become turbulent, does the velocity derive to expansion in main body?
Yes. Well, yeah, I was going to mention that later. But yeah, the thing is, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, you're pushing everything to longer distance scales. And so that's getting more into the regime of validity of the derivative expansion. But in higher dimensions, you would expect the reverse. And it's not clear what would happen. That's a good question. So yeah, but the thing I wanted to point out here is that this Weil invariant is very closely related to the vorticity. And you can also, yeah.
So what is the shear flow in the bulk?
The shear flow in the bulk is the lowest shear hydrodynamic quasi-normal mode. It's a particular quasi-normal mode that we're now looking at the nonlinear level. When different shear hydrodynamic modes are allowed to interact with each other. Yeah, it's a very nice kind of perturbative method to see this. So here is another Weil invariant in the square of the Weil tensor, and that's very closely related to the density on the fluid. And I think this has to do with, you know, I think the vorticity is related to the magnetic part of the Weil tensor when you decompose it in the radial direction, and this density is related to the electric part. I'm still working on sorting out all those details. Okay, so the question, you know, was asked was like, well, is this derivative expansion valid? Can we trust all of this? And yeah, it's a good question. And I think the clearest demonstration that it is valid is that these guys, Adams, Chesler, and Liu, did pure gravity simulations in 3 plus 1 dimensions of the same system. So they're studying the gravity side. And these are the results of their simulations when they work out the boundary vorticity. And well, these are the results of our simulations, and as you can see, they look fairly similar. So I think this is a pretty good demonstration that this turbulence is happening in the actual space-time. Yeah. So I think this gives us some new intuition for gravity, which is that mainly that ordinary perturbation theory is not valid in the low dissipation regime. So, you know, when you have long-lived gravitational modes, you have to worry about, you know, it's not a question of how big is your perturbation. It's a question of how big is your next order correction if you were to go to higher order in perturbation theory. In other words, how big are the nonlinear terms compared to the dissipative terms? And it, just like with fluids, it makes sense then to define a gravitational Reynolds number that measures the relative sizes of the nonlinear terms and the dissipative terms in the equations. So if you have very long-lived quasi-normal modes, you're into a high Reynolds number regime. So in this fluid gravity setup, I mean, just by translating quantities from the boundary into the bulk, the gravitational Reynolds number would go as the temperature of this black brain times the metric perturbation times the wavelength of the perturbation. And then we have this correspondence where laminar flow for a fluid corresponds to the quasi-normal mode regime of the gravity, and turbulent flow of the fluid corresponds to this new turbulent phase. Now, for high gravitational Reynolds number, you're going to need some sort of improved perturbation theory in order to capture the relevant dynamics. You could go to very high orders in ordinary perturbation theory, and you know, you would begin to see this exponential growth, but it won't be manifest. So what one needs to do is to adopt methods from fluid dynamics that focus on, say, the nonlinear coupling of the modes. So for, just as an example, in fluid dynamics, you're not going to see the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability by just perturbing a uniform fluid unless you go to high order. What you want to do is you want to study the decaying mode, the shear mode, and look at its stability. That's what you would do in fluid dynamics, and that's what you should do in gravity. And in fact, maybe Aaron will talk about this in his next talk. There's an example of these highly rotating black holes which have quasi-normal modes, and he, Huan Yang, and Luis have done that sort of perturbation theory to see this growing mode. Another way you might want to look at things just in terms of like a mode coupling picture, and that's what I'm going to talk about in the next part of my talk. So a couple extensions or open questions is, well, what happens in higher dimensions where you expect a direct cascade to small scales? Is there some sort of fundamental difference between 4 and 5 dimensions in space-time? Well, beyond anti-de Sitter spacetime, are there cases of turbulence? Well, we have, like I just mentioned, there's this case of very long-lived modes in near-extremal Kerr, which exhibit the same sort of initial instability. Well, I don't know if there's any other cases beyond that. And then this conserved entropy, I mean, I'd like to understand it a bit better. Does it hold beyond the gravity-fluid correspondence? How generally does it hold? And does it act as a cosmic sensor? So what we see here is when we perturb this black hole, the entropy tends to push things to smaller scales and kind of smooth out the perturbation, as opposed to higher dimensions where you would expect cascades to high frequencies that might disrupt the black hole and, who knows, maybe cause it to break apart, like that we've seen in the black string. Okay, now I'm going to shift gears, and I'm going to talk about pure anti-de Sitter spacetime. So now I'm going to throw away that black hole. So just think of anti-de Sitter spacetime as a box, a spherical box with a reflecting boundary. It's the easiest way to think about it. And now, if I had a linear field living in that box, it wouldn't have quasi-normal modes, but it would have normal modes with harmonic time dependence, because there's no dissipation. And in fact, in the language of what I was just saying, it has an infinite Reynolds number. Of course, non-linearly, these mode couplings do exist, because these modes are going to self-gravitate with each other. And you can get energy transfers between these modes in a sort of turbulent cascade. And then if you transfer enough of that energy to very high frequencies or short distance scales, you could see a black hole form. So the question is ADS stable to arbitrarily small perturbations? And if not, which initial data do collapse to form a black hole? So if you're thinking of ADS CFT, which I'm not necessarily, then you would be, this is a question of, will the CFT thermalize? So this is a pretty tough problem if we want to say numerically simulate it. So what's often done is to restrict to spherical symmetry. So we play with this toy model where we have gravity plus a negative cosmological constant, and we add in here a real massless scalar field for the reason that gravity doesn't have any dynamics on its own in spherical symmetry, and we need to add some sort of degree of freedom. So we'll study this system. So this was first studied numerically by Bizon and Rostorowski. So what they did was they put an initial Gaussian pulse of field into this space-time, and it propagates over to infinity, and then it bounces back, and then it goes over to, this is just a this is just the axis of symmetry of the space-time, and it keeps going back and forth through the space-time, it keeps bouncing, and if you look really closely, you can tell it's in fact steepening a little bit, and it's getting more peaked. I'm not going to run this whole simulation, but what happens in the end is that it gets so peaked that it forms into a black hole. And this happens no matter how small they take the initial amplitude. So this famous plot of Bizon and Rostorowski here, they plot the size of the black hole it forms versus the initial amplitude of that perturbation. And for a very large amplitude, say greater than 43 in this plot, it just forms into a black hole right away. As they decrease epsilon, it goes through one bounce, so it'll bounce once and then form a black hole, and then two bounces, three bounces, and so on. And they take epsilon very small, and no matter how small they take it, they always see a black hole form. So we have here, I'm plotting the curvature at the origin versus time, and each of these curves represents different values of epsilon. And they keep taking epsilon smaller, it collapses later, but it will always collapse. In fact, there's this scaling symmetry that emerges that seems to suggest you could take it arbitrarily small. So just to recall, like I said, ADS is a confining mirrored box, so you have these normal modes, and this sharpening of Gaussian that we saw, you can think of that as a transfer of energy to high frequency modes, if you think in Fourier space. And then those modes lead to collapse because they're more highly peaked. And they call this the gravitational turbulent instability of ADS. But it turns out that's not the whole story, because some later simulations showed that, well, Bizon and Rostorowski just varied the amplitude, but Luis and Alex and Steve, they varied the width of the Gaussian. And it turns out then that you don't always get a collapse. So here they're plotting the time to collapse versus the amplitude for various different widths of the Gaussian. And for some cases, as you take the amplitude to zero, you always get a collapse. But in other cases, once you take the amplitude below some critical value, the collapse time just goes to infinity and you don't get anything. So what's happening here? What distinguishes these initial data? And to make progress, we're going to go beyond numerical simulations and do some perturbative analysis, which is motivated a lot by what I talked about before. So first, let's try ordinary perturbation theory, which is what Bizon tried when he looked at it. So you look at a free scalar field in ADS. That's your lowest order in perturbation theory. So you have, it obeys a wave equation, phi double dot plus some spatial differential operator acting on phi is equal to zero. And then you can write your general solution to that wave equation in terms of eigenfunctions and eigenvalues of L. So I'm going to be explicit here because it's going to be relevant later. I'm going to write phi as a sum over modes j, labeled by index j, of an amplitude aj, which is complex, times a harmonic time dependence, e to the minus I omega jt, where omega j is linear in j, it's 2j plus 3 in four dimensions, and times a spatial wave function ej of x. So that form is important. At second order, I calculate the gravitational field due to this phi. I mean, it's just using the constraint equations. And then I go to third order, and I get to see the effect of that gravitational perturbation back on the phi, the scalar. So I get an equation which has the same homogeneous part as this one, but in now a source that's cubic in phi 1. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't hear. What?
Each divided by I omega plus minus I omega. One of them grows for plus normal.
Yeah, but these are normal modes, so these are just both oscillating. The reason I have two here is because I want it to be a real solution, and one is just the complex conjugate of the other.
So there is no
quasi-normal modes. There's no dissipation in this case. They're just normal modes. But that's important because they're going to persist forever, and they're going to interact nonlinearly. No black hole, just empty ADS, and I'm looking at how these normal modes interact. So, and what the key thing is that these frequencies are all linear in J. So it's a fully commensurate frequency spectrum. So that means that if I look at this equation, it's full of resonances. Whenever some frequencies here on the right-hand side add up to one of the normal frequencies on the left-hand side, I'm gonna get a secular growth in my solution, and that's gonna lead to the breakdown of this perturbation theory. So as a really simple example, I can imagine exciting two modes initially. So the lowest two modes. So my initial data consists of the zeroth mode and the first mode and amplitude epsilon. If I calculate the solution to third order in perturbation theory, I find, well, of course, to order epsilon, each of these just picks up the expected harmonic time dependence. But at third order in the perturbation theory, I get a term that goes as epsilon cubed times t times sine 7t. Well, you know, after a time t proportional to 1 over epsilon squared, this term is going to be bigger than my leading term, and the perturbation theory is no good. So people initially argue, well, this is why we have the instability, but really that's not the whole story. So it's just telling you your perturbation theory is breaking down. So what we used was a two-timescale perturbation theory, which really captures the interactions between the modes. So now remember, there's two times involved in this whole problem. We have our normal mode oscillation timescale, which is fixed independent of the amplitude of the perturbation. But we also have this timescale for the black hole to form, right? Because you saw in the simulation, we have all these bounces. Each bounce, hardly anything changes, but there's a small change to the shape of that wave function. So we want to capture that small change in the shape of that wave function and effectively integrate out this fast time oscillation. So the way we do that is we introduce this slow time variable, which I call tau, which is epsilon squared times t, epsilon being the amplitude of the perturbation. And now I'm going to allow all of my fields to depend on tau and t, as well as x. And I expand perturbatively as before. And I'm going to do perturbation theory just as before, but with this allowed extra dependence. So at zeroth order, I get the same solution as before, except that now these mode amplitudes aj, they depend on the slow time variable tau. This is the general solution at leading order. But these are completely free functions at this point. So if I continue through my perturbation theory and I go to order epsilon cubed, where we previously encountered those resonances in ordinary perturbation theory, we can use that freedom in the AJs to cancel off all of those resonances. In other words, if we require this equation to hold, then all of the resonant interactions are precisely accounted for in the dynamics of these coefficients aj of tau. So this equation, I'm not going to derive it, but it tells you that, you know, the tau derivative of aj has to be the sum of these cubic terms in the other a's. So it just accounting for these cubic interactions between these coupled oscillators. So now our dynamical variables are really these AJs, and those are the relevant ones. And we're going to study this. And I call it the TTF equations for a two-time framework. Now, there's these coefficients, these S's here. And these arise from overlap integrals of the mode functions. They're fairly complicated to calculate. But they obey this curious resonance condition in that they vanish unless you have J plus K equal to L plus M. And a priori, you would have expected some terms with minus signs in here. So most of the resonance channels, in fact, are zero. And if I was to do this in, say, a flat space cavity in flat space, not in ADS, this resonance condition wouldn't hold. So this is a very special thing to ADS spacetime, and I'll come back to it later. So the rest of this talk is going to focus on analyzing these equations, these TTF equations, and how they might explain collapse versus non-collapse. So let's look at the collapsing data that Bizon studied. So remember these plots from before, we see the blow up of the curvature at the origin. Well, if we look at this in mode space, this is again looking at the full equations. What they see this is a mode spectrum of plotting the energy per mode as a function of J, it forms into a power law energy spectrum. And this power law energy spectrum will eventually extend all the way out to here. And it puts a ton of energy in the high frequency modes and is what it leads to this divergence when you go back and try to calculate the curvature of the origin. Now I can look at the TTF equations. And well, this is what I get. So you have to truncate your equations. I'm using 400 modes here. You start off with this blue curve is time t equals zero. Again, I'm plotting the energy spectrum. And it forms into a power law also with the same slope as what Bizon and Rostorowski saw. So we're seeing the same kind of behavior in the TTF. But I'm going to look at non-collapsing initial data. So that I'll look at this particular example where I divide the energy evenly between the first two modes initially. And this is what I get. It looks very different. So I'm looking at the energy per mode for the first six modes as a function of time. And the solid curves here are the full simulation, and the dotted ones are the results of the TTF. And as you can see, they match up pretty nicely. But it's I don't just get this transfer of energy to the high frequencies, I get this recurrence happening. After over long time scales, I come back almost to the initial state where the energy is in the first two modes. So I see the energy go out of mode 0 and 1, it goes into mode 0, but then it also goes into modes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, and then it goes back. Now this is reminiscent of this recurrence behavior that's seen in these Fermi-Pasta-Ulam oscillators, where these Fermi-Pasta and Ulam decided to numerically simulate a bunch of coupled oscillators, and they put the energy into one mode, and they expected it to thermalize, but then it went back, it returned to the original state eventually. So it's not so surprising when you think that the system is just a bunch of coupled oscillators. And again, I can look at the curvature of the origin, and I get that it doesn't blow up. It increases for a while, and then it goes back down. So we have direct cascades and inverse cascades. OK, now one of the interesting things about these TTF equations is that they conserve three quantities. So we have the energy, as we expect, which is just omega j squared, aj squared. But then we have this very peculiar particle number-like quantity, which is just one power of omega, and is otherwise the same as the energy. And we also have the Hamiltonian, which is, I think, less interesting. And these two are associated to two U1 symmetries of the Hamiltonian. But that conserved particle number is very unexpected for a real scalar field. And it also holds beyond spherical symmetry. And it can be traced back to the fact that so many of those resonance channels where you had different combinations of pluses and minus signs don't exist. And it's a special property of ADS, and it's been, and people have said it has to do with some sort of hidden symmetry, and that I'm still trying to understand that a little bit better. But the idea is that SO3 symmetry of ADS is in fact enhanced to some sort of SU3 symmetry. But yeah. So, but when you have two conserved quantities, like before, you have dual turbulent cascades. Oops. Okay. And so it's easy to understand. If you have your energy all in the lowest modes, and you want to move it all up to higher frequency modes, you can imagine doing that, but that would decrease your particle number because the higher frequency modes have more energy per particle. So what you really have to do is you have to put some of that energy back into the lower modes. And we see this, in fact. So this explains why you had that energy transfer into mode zero at the beginning here, which was totally unexplained until then. Okay, also with the TTF, what we can do is look for equilibrium solutions. So I'm going to look for solutions where each mode is excited, but they have a constant energy per mode. So the amplitude of each mode stays constant. And if I look for solutions like this, I find a two-parameter family of solutions which with energy spectra which roughly look like exponential. They have a peak mode, same mode zero, and everything in an exponential decay beyond that. So if I evolve these modes, then the energy just stays constant per mode. And I can describe, since it's a two-parameter family of solutions, I can take those two parameters to be, for example, the energy and the particle number, these are conserved quantities, or I can take it to be a temperature, which is just the ratio of those in an overall scale. So I have all these quasi-periodic equilibrium solutions. There's in fact a whole bunch more of these equilibrium solutions that are peaked at different mode numbers. So they have dominant modes and then they have exponential decays to both sides. And then there's some that look totally different. So there's a whole bunch of equilibrium solutions. So the question to ask is, are these equilibrium solutions stable? So we took some of them and we plugged them into a simulation. And as you can see, so here's there's like five equilibrium solutions or perturbations thereof. And the simulation just oscillates around these equilibria. Ignore this stuff up here. This is just a bunch of noise. But here we have these exponentials and these oscillations. Okay. And then we can also do a linear stability analysis. Not numerical, and we did that, and we found, in fact, that all of these solutions, which have these peak modes, they're stable at the linear level, and this is within TTF, we did this analysis, and these funny-looking ones are unstable, so we can kind of ignore these. But the nice thing is, when you do this linear stability analysis, you get your oscillation frequencies out as a byproduct. And the claim now is that the reason we have solutions that don't collapse is because these solutions are sufficiently close to these equilibrium solutions. And really, these equilibrium solutions act as islands of stability. And the non-collapsing solutions are just oscillating around these islands. So what we can do is we can match initial data, say the two-mode initial data, to an equilibrium solution, by just matching the values of the total conserved particle number and energy. I can compute the E and the N for my initial spectrum, and then that'll give rise to a quasi-periodic solution. And then I can study this quasi-periodic solution and the oscillation frequencies about this solution, and that will in fact give rise to the recurrence times that we saw before, that similar to what you see in these Fermi-Pasta-Ulam problem. Okay, so just to illustrate that visually, I can interpolate my initial data starting with, this is the two-mode data, what we saw before, and I can interpolate the initial data between that and the quasi-periodic solution associated to it. So if I move closer to the quasi-periodic, the oscillation amplitudes get smaller, but the wavelengths don't change all that much. I keep going closer, and now I'm 9/10 of the way there, and now I see I have small oscillations around it, but that oscillation period is quite closely related. It comes out of the stability analysis, and it's close enough, or it's reasonably close to this oscillation period here. So we can really interpret these oscillations as just oscillations about these equilibrium solutions, which are really the islands of stability. So to conclude there, this TTF, this enhanced perturbation theory, it models the ADS scalar system for small amplitude perturbations for timescales proportional to 1 over epsilon squared, which you didn't have before. And it led us to uncover this conserved particle number, this energy in the Hamiltonian, these stable quasi-periodic solutions, and this direct calculation of the recurrence times. A big outstanding question is, what happens beyond spherical symmetry? Well, we have the conserved particle number still, but it's not clear. There's no kind of central point for a black hole to form, so we don't have this preferred point, and there's a lot more phase space to deal with, and it's not clear what will happen beyond the spherical approximation. So my overall conclusions for my talk then are that in the presence of long-lived quasi-normal or normal modes, standard approaches to gravitational perturbations break down. And this is this high gravitational Reynolds number regime. The question is, are there natural high gravitational Reynolds number regimes beyond ADS? ADS was very special. And one example is this near extreme Kerr that maybe Aaron will talk about. I'm curious if there's applications in cosmology, maybe between cosmological modes, I don't know. And the other thing is that these turbulent cascades are strongly influenced by the presence of these conserved quantities. So both of these particle numbers and entropy were found to be conserved at this perturbative level, nonlinear but perturbative. And do they extend beyond this level? Are there any analogs of these ADS conserved quantities in de Sitter spacetimes that might be relevant to cosmology? And what role do these play in fundamental gravity questions? Like, well, I've talked about stability. There's this question of cosmic censorship by this smoothing of this entropy. But these are all questions for the future. Thanks.
Questions?
Two questions. How do you extract information from the LIGO waveform ring down that can test your model? Secondly, for high Reynolds number, do you expect to see in the cascades fractal and scale invariant behavior?
Okay, so for the first question, with regard to the ADS, if we lived in the ADS spacetime and we built a LIGO detector there, then, Aaron will talk about the asymptotically flat case maybe, but if you built that, that would be, what you would see is you would have different final frequencies. You would have energy move between, say you were perturbing your black hole at some frequency, say if you had like a in spiral into some large black hole or something, this is maybe Lisa, but you would see modes at different frequencies. So it would generate additional quasi-normal modes, aside from the initial one, non-linearly. The second question, self-similar behavior, we kind of see that in the turbulence picture. You see like these eddies form larger and larger quantities. So.
Do you suspect that there's a space-time symmetry behind this conserved particle number?
It's a good question. It's not a space-time symmetry because it's not associated to an isometry. So I think it's associated to a hidden symmetry, which is a symmetry of the field equations, or the Lagrangian, but not a symmetry of the space-time. So a good example is like this Runge-Lenz vector, which is not associated to an isometry. So it's
I guess the reason that I might suspect that is that restricting to spherical symmetry, there's only, the scalar field and the scalar gravitational perturbation are kind of the same thing.
So
maybe there's some gauge transformation. Some gauge transformation that this course, like, it's a gauge degree of freedom.
Yeah, I don't think this is a gauge. Well, this won't be a gauge degree of freedom. You see it. The scalar field, for example, you see this, and there's no gauge freedom in the scalar field. But
there is once it turns into the same thing as the gravitational potential.
So this holds beyond spherical symmetry too, either for the scalar field or the gravitational field. I don't think it would be I mean, the gauge symmetry is the Diffeos, and I mean, it's just something special for ADS. So it's somehow related to ADS spacetime and field equations in ADS. So.
Any other question? So I guess not. So we're going to reconvene in half an hour at 10:50. We're going to have a coffee break. Let's thank one more time, Stephen.